Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing smart people doing dumb things with their money with Jill Schlesinger.
We all make some financial mistakes from time to time, but hopefully through reading, listening to podcasts, and learning from our previous mistakes, we can move forward and make smarter moves with our money. That's what we're covering during this interview. Our guest today is Jill Schlesinger, who is an on-air CBS News business analyst, and she covers the economy and business as she guides people through their personal financial decisions. Jill is a certified financial planner and also the author of the book, The Dumb Things That Smart People Do With Their Money. We're going to spend some time talking about a lot of those dumb things today. So Jill, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. This is such an honor. I feel very blessed to be with you guys.
Well, we feel very blessed that you're here with us. And one dumb thing that people do, Jill, is they drink beer when they're talking about money. And that's what Matt and I do. We drink beer.
Consider that nice. To be wise, not dumb.
And today on the show, we're drinking a IPA called Wedge Salad. And it's by two different breweries, collaboration beer. But I wanted to ask you, since Matt and I, we intentionally drink a craft beer on every episode, and it's kind of this splurge that we partake in while we're saving and investing well for our future. So I wanted to ask you, what is your splurge? What's your craft beer equivalent?
I do a couple of different things seasonally. And I think that that's very important because I just don't want you to think I'm a complete boozer all the time without any idea about what my surroundings are. So I live in the Northeast. In the wintertime, I do love bourbon. I love single malt scotches. But, you know, here we are coming into the summer, and I do really like myself a little tequila. So I can do tequila gin in the summer and amber liquors all other times of the year.
Man, Jill, we could hang on the reg.
Yeah, I feel like my wife in particular starts drinking more tequila in the spring and the summer. You know, like once Cinco de Mayo's hit, like the rest of the summer, it's just wide open to margaritas.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even do margaritas because to me, adding sugar is just a devastating bad idea. And I always feel it the next morning. So I'm just straight up. That's it. Give me a little Blanco, rocks, a little bit of lime, done.
Nice.
There you go.
I like it. Well, Jill, let's kind of dive into it here. Your family has a fascinating history with money. You come from a long line of Wall Street traders, and you followed in your father's footsteps as well. So what was it like trading on the floor of the New York Commodities Exchange?
I always like to think of it as it's a frat party meets a rugby scrum. And if you think about that, you know, I am a woman of a certain age, i.e. mid-50s. And so the idea of Animal House, but we do it actually wearing uniforms and in a rugby scrum kind of seems about right. And I was one of eight women with 800 men, which I didn't mind much. I mean, not that I was out and gay then, but I was very comfortable around men because I grew up playing sports my whole life and being the only girl out there. But it was disgusting. I mean, honestly, the whole Me Too movement, I had just the most awful things done to me, not violent things, but like disgusting things every day. Yeah. And not that, you know, anyone would like sort of feel you up in the middle of a trading pit, but they would elbow you and jostle you and shove you and pull your hair and, you know, call you really awful words that nice girls from Scarsdale, New York don't ever say or think about saying.
Right.
And so just like in the first week of my career on Wall Street as a commodities trader, I was called an effing idiot in front of a huge crowd of people.
Oh.
And I just wanted to cry. In fact, I went to the bathroom to cry. But anyway, it was a great place to have worked. It's like being in a place where you're like, it was a great place to grow up, and I'm glad I never have to go back there.
Glad to be done with it.
You got
done
it.
With all that craziness.
You betcha.
Yeah, that sounds like being one of eight females in a group of 900 men. That's going to leave an impression on you. That's especially 30 years ago, right? It's a different time.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. In one of the funniest things that like early in my career, I had a boss who was a tough guy from Chicago, and a lot of, so I was an options trader. I didn't trade futures contracts. I traded the derivatives, the contract that derived its value from the futures contract. So I traded gold, silver, and copper options. And options is sort of a mathematical sport in some respects. And as a result, you know, you got this weird mix of sort of tough asses mixed with, you know, math nerds and everyone in between. And I remember my first boss was sort of this math nerd from University of Chicago, but he was sort of a tough guy too. And he said to me, you went to an Ivy League school, didn't you? And I thought, oh, he's like recognizing me. I'm so happy. I felt so good about myself. I said, oh, yeah, sure.
Validation.
Exactly. I'm like, yes. He goes, which one? I said, Brown. Brown, yeah. He goes, what's that, like in Rhode Island or something? I said, yeah. He goes, you can take your Ivy League degree and stick it up your butt down here. No one gives a crap where you've come from. And that was like, okay, I'm never mentioning that again.
You thought he was going to have this nice genial conversation, but not so much.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Well, and Jill, I want to ask about when you went to Brown, you were a soccer player. You played soccer in high school. You played soccer in college. You mentioned kind of, too, that trading pit was kind of like a sporting event. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, do you feel like that soccer, the fast-paced environment of playing high school and college sports kind of prepared you for maybe something that most people wouldn't be prepared for?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting when the only reason, I mean, look, there's a few reasons that I got this job. First of all, my dad was a trader on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. My uncle was a trader on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. So I had experience on a physical trading floor, which essentially is like unheard of now, right? And then when companies would recruit for people to trade on the physical trading floor, they always wanted to work with athletes. They actually went to recruit athletes.
No way.
Yeah. And there's a couple of reasons why. One is that you have the idea of making decisions on your feet. You have the idea of, I know how to lose and move on. And you have the idea of actually physically being able to manage it. I wanted to be a trader in the oil pit, but I wasn't big enough. And I'm 5'11", but I wasn't big. They thought I'd get pushed around too much.
That is really so crazy. I've never heard it described just from that much of a physical standpoint. Like, you said literally, you're making decisions on your feet. Like, literally, you're on your feet making decisions running around.
That's
but,
right.
Yeah, I wasn't quite aware of the physical nature of being in the pit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of your brass knuckles ready.
Exactly.
Well, Jill, you know, I've heard you say that you didn't like making money, you know, quite as much as maybe you thought you would. That kind of seems like maybe an almost enlightened point of view, you know, especially for a money expert. So how did you come to that realization? And like, what did you mean by that?
Well, you know, when I was a young trader, there was it was the late 80s. I mean, I started trading the summer of 1987, meaning I didn't even trade. I was started as a clerk on the floor of the Commodities Exchange. By August, almost September, they were the people who had hired me, this firm that no longer exists anymore, it's been subsumed already, they said, okay, everyone's making so much money, let's just put these kids out there. And my boss's boss sat us down and said, there are six of you here. We hope that half of you lose all the money in the account and no more. Two of you make decent money and one's a knock your socks out performer. And so you each have $1 million limit in your account. We will not allow you to lose more than $1 million. As soon as you lose $1 million, you are done and you're fired and don't even show up for work the next
wow.
day. So what was interesting is that, you know, I was sort of like the single and doubles double hitter. You know, I was the one who was like finished the year. You know, we had the big market crash in October of 87. I made a bunch of money. I worked for almost a whole year after that. So 1988, I traded. And I remember in basically around the end of the year, I was talking to my dad and his business partner, and I said, you know, gosh, I think I'll just buy my own seat. I'll trade for myself, and, you know, I can afford to buy the seat myself, but I need money. And so they backed me. They put money in an account, and we split it. And then, you know, I was clicking along, making decent money, and I had one bonanza month. Like in 1989 in the summer, I had a huge month, and my dad's over in my teeny tiny rent-controlled studio apartment, and he's looking at my profit and loss statement, just we had physical sheets. And he goes, honey, you had some month. What a month. And I turned to him. I'm like, yeah. And he looked at me and he said, what do you mean, yeah? I said, yes, it was a good month. He said, you made more money in that 1 month than most of your peers will make in an entire year and maybe a couple of years. And you know what, honey? If you don't get any thrill out of making money when the money's there to be made, I don't know if this is the right business for you because there's nothing else. It really isn't. So you've got to love making the money. You have to know that it is, you're not, you know, finding the great cause to advance. You're not, you know, bringing a company public even. You're not, you're an intermediary who picks up, at that time we used to say eighths and steenths, you know, little fractions of a trade. And it's fun. And he said, and I've loved it my whole life because I had flexibility and I could come home and watch every single one of your soccer and basketball games and be part of you and your sister's lives and not be like the idiots who are, you know, lawyers and doctors and have no life. But if you don't like that, if you don't like making money, you're going to have a problem. And it stuck with me. And it took me like another couple of years before I said, I don't really like this that much. I don't feel good about myself. I don't feel like I don't like who I am on the trading floor. And I feel like it's important that I figure out how to be a little bit truer to what makes me happy. And that was it. I was done.
Yeah. So how did you go about quitting then? What did that look like?
Well, first I cried and told my parents. Because, you know, you have to understand there was like this great unspoken expectation that I was going to go into my father's firm. Mm. And all of his partners had that expectation, and I had that expectation. So that was one very difficult aspect of it. I was dating somebody who was in medical school, actually up at Brown, and I felt like it was great because I could sort of escape and not really deal with my career indecision. You know, and by the way, people didn't just quit jobs then. You know, we are not of that same generation. Sorry, that's my dog Trixie. She's
that's all right.
Wanted to underscore that. So I think that it was, so I went up to Rhode Island and I kind of started over and I figured I'd be there a couple of years while, you know, medical school finished up for my partner at the time and then just figure it out. And that was it. It was sort of like this weird interim move that was supposed to be just a couple of years and maybe come back to New York and see what happens next.
Cool. Yeah. And now you're big time CBS News analyst, Jill Schlesinger. So yeah, what's your role look like in media? How do you like that job? How's that transition been? Is it better than getting jostled in the pit?
Well, in between jostling in the pit and media, I was an investment advisor, a certified financial planner and an investment advisor, a little company up in New England, grew it from nothing, became very big, and then sold it. I did it for 14 years and I had clients and it was great because I really did feel like, wow, this is a way for me to use my financial acumen, my love of solving problems, but bring it to somebody and fix a real issue, not a academic statistical question, which is really what it is to trade a derivatives contract. It's just like a great puzzle. It's like the Rubik's Cube of money making. You know, you're just like, oh, this is so cool. And you get into a rhythm and it feels great. So I did that for 14 years. And one of the ways that we grew our business was we hosted a radio show. And then that led to doing some television. And I had two really wonderful people who kind of guided me and said, hey, you're really good at this radio. You're really good at this TV. Even though it's not your primary business, we'd love to talk to you as if it were. We're going to treat you like talent. And I said, oh, great. As long as I get people to fork over their money and let me manage it, that's fine. You know, that's all I cared about. And then slowly but surely, I started getting more national exposure. And then right in the beginning of the financial crisis, early on, someone from CBS saw me on CNN and they called me up and said, you know, would you be willing to come here and, you know, are you exclusive there? No. And so I started doing some stuff for CBS. In the beginning of 2009, I was done with my business. I had sold it. I had done my contract and ready to move on. And someone called me from CBS Talent and said, we're hiring and we really think you should talk to us and do this. And I said, oh my God, I've been working 7 days a week, 24/7, clients, employees. I can't even think about this. I'm not doing anything. And 3 weeks later, I signed a contract and that was 11 years ago.
And you've been doing
this history.
Yeah, since then.
Yeah, well, it's awesome. Let me just say this, that being in the media, fantastic job. It's like the best job I've ever had. I'm the luckiest person in the world. It is so, it's like a supreme delight. It's like, I'm sure you guys feel this way. It's like you are helping people, giving them information. It's actionable. It's great. There's nothing, there's no downside. I mean, and they do my hair and makeup in their normal circumstances.
Right. It's even better when you're a podcaster. You don't even have to do hair and makeup. It's
right.
Great.
Yeah. Exactly. No, yeah,
I mean, I don't know how often we think about podcasting as media. And I mean, we know it is, like, from a, you know, head knowledge standpoint. But obviously, yeah, certainly the ability to impact individuals' lives and help them when it comes to their personal finances and money, certainly incredibly rewarding. And Jill, we're going to dive into your book. We're going to talk about some of the specific dumb things that, you know, we all might do with our money. We're going to talk about that, as well as maybe a little bit too how the pandemic has impacted our personal finances. And we'll get to that right after the break.
All right, we're back from break. We're talking with Jill Schlesinger. And Jill, it's time to dive into some stuff about how people handle their money. Would love hearing your backstory and the trading. Fascinating stuff. But let's talk about people's emotions when it comes to our finances. And in your book, you argue that even the smartest individuals out there can do incredibly stupid things with their money. So how do otherwise smart people end up making idiotic decisions when it comes to their finances?
Unfortunately, they are afflicted with this condition called being a human being. and you know, don't you feel it all the time, even in yourself? You know these sort of golden rules of how to manage your money, about your financial life, and you even feel the drift of your emotions starting to inflict something on you. And it's like the sense that I really want to do this, but I can't. And so the analogy I always give is diet and exercise. You know, everybody knows exactly what to do.
Such a good example. Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like, you know what to do. You don't have to buy another stupid diet book. You don't need to, you know, move your body and don't eat as much. Okay? Yeah. It's really, it doesn't matter even what it is. So it's the same thing with personal finance. You kind of know what you should be doing. And you don't do it. And mostly it's just because you're a human being and our emotions are so, so strong. And one of the things I wanted to do in the book was to explore the emotional pull. Because, listen, when I was an investment advisor, I gave advice to people who were far smarter than I. They were really, you know, they were geniuses, they were physicists, and there were, you know, academics, and they were lawyers, and they were doctors. These people were super smart. But again, they were just human beings and they couldn't get out of their own way. Mm. And I think that's really the root cause of most financial problems, is that your emotions take over and it's really difficult to control them.
If the problem's us being human, if it's humanity in general, that makes the solution really difficult.
Exactly. But you know, what's interesting, I would say, is that so much of what you can do today takes that emotional element out of it. You know, if you go back in time, if you kind of wind the clock back and I say 20 years ago when I was giving financial advice, we didn't have automatic trading platforms for individuals, and we didn't have auto rebalancing, and we didn't have auto enrollment. So these automatic technological solutions are actually helping people stay out of trouble. Not enough, but yes, they really are.
Yeah, it's a good step in the right direction. Kind of as you talk about the book, you talk about these emotional blind spots that we have. How can, like, individuals essentially identify which blind spot they have? Because obviously, if they're not even aware of it to begin with, how do they know to work on, you know, that specific area? Like, so how would you recommend for individuals to identify their own emotional blind spots?
Well, I think part of it is you have to be aware, a self-aware person. So if you're just blithely walking through life, I'm probably not going to help you. And you're not going to buy my book anyway, because you probably don't think that you're making a mistake at all. But most of us, I think, are mature enough to realize that there are things that we are doing in our financial life that maybe don't look so great. And part of it is maybe it's just something you're not able to do. Why am I unable to actually get me and my partner to sit down and draft our estate documents? Or why am I staying up at night worrying about my 401k? Or why is it that I every time I say I want to do something in the financial realm, I second guess myself a zillion times? And frankly, you know, from the pretty base level, there are people who know they're in trouble financially, and chances are you got there for some reason. Some of those mistakes are really hard to eradicate. But I can't go back in time and say, gosh, I wish that you did not go to a fourth tier private school, rack up a bunch of debt for no reason. Like, I really do wish that most people didn't do that. The chapter about college funding in the book is essentially, the thesis is, if you can go to a top tier school and there's a real name brand that's going to help propel a kid, then sure. Or if you're really rich and you can afford to send your kid to a 4-year party and you don't care, fine, go spend your money. I don't care. I'm more worried about the people in the middle who are borrowing a ton of money as parents, yeah, putting kids who are accumulating debt. They come out of a high priced private school that is not a name brand. And it does nothing for them. And so I worry about those people. But when I was shopping around at the book, when I was just had a proposal, I made a comment, and I don't know where you guys went to college, so I'll just make it tell you that, like, I basically said to them, you know, like, if you were so stupid to spend $200,000 on what's the matter you, and I named the college, and a woman's face, the blood was drawn from her face. She's like, I went to that school.
It's like, that's me.
Yeah. So honestly, I didn't get
hopefully
her to bid on the project. Yeah, yeah. No. And so, you know, so one of the things that I think happens is that people, when they want to do well for their kids, they want to do well for their families, they don't really know the right questions to ask. They sort of take certain rules of thumb from a previous generation, they apply it to them, and in the end, unfortunately, what a lot of people will do is they'll just sort of make a bad decision, not because they're dumb, but because they don't know they don't know the right way, where to turn. So, yeah, you know, that to me is sort of your critical factor, that like something is in your life and you're agonizing over it. I had a colleague at work, his son just got into all these different schools, and, you know, we went through all the numbers, and in one scenario, the kid ends up graduating with $90,000 in debt, and the other one, he has zero debt. So I had a conversation with the kid. I said, I want to explain to you what $90,000 in debt looks like when, you know, I want to just push forward 5 years and tell you what that looks like. And it was great coming from me, because he's like, oh, I don't want that.
Yeah, that's a lot of people, kids graduate from college, finding themselves in that situation. It's not a pretty place to be. Yeah. So, Jill, I want to ask you the number one thing you wrote about in your book, that the first of all the dumb money moves that even smart people tend to make, you said, is buying financial products that we don't understand. So you talked about infomercials selling precious metals, or potentially a golfing buddy pitching you an annuity. And they both sound so good in the moment. And it's so easy in a quick 1-minute pitch to feel like, yeah, that sounds pretty nice. I need to take advantage of that. But how do we avoid that one? How do we avoid getting a financial product, putting our money into something that we don't really comprehend?
Well, I think that when somebody is approaching you with an idea, the first thing is, if you don't really understand it and you can't explain it to somebody else, chances are, put the brakes on. You need more information. But also, this also gets into the idea that you not only are buying products that you don't understand, but you're buying from people that don't have your best interest at heart. And to me, this is incredibly important. This is called the fiduciary standard, which you guys, I know, are familiar with. But it just means that in the world of financial professionals, it's so strange, but most people who are in financial services are not required to put you first. They're required to give you advice that's suitable to you, but not the best advice for you. And there's something really crazy about that. I know, it's a head scratcher. Yeah. But one of the things that I always say is that until you understand whether the person is held to this fiduciary standard or not, it's, you just know that you're being sold something. And if you're being sold something, you approach it in a different way. And if you don't understand what you're being sold, then you just pause and you can get another opinion. And if you really don't understand it after trying to understand it like for hours, then just don't do it. The complexity of most products is a tell. the complexity tells you if you get like this 400-page document along, like your broker, your salesman says, here, you know, here's, you don't have to read the whole, this whole thing. This is what it is. The thicker that document, the more risk it has to you. And chances are the more money it will make for him who's selling it to you.
Well, Jill, speaking of risk, I've seen before that, you know, you've recommended to folks to have like 6 to 12 months of expenses, right, in an emergency fund. Like, this pretty basic advice as far as having that margin, having that cash cushion. And this was even before the great lockdown. You know, has your advice to folks changed due to the pandemic?
No, but don't I sound brilliant now?
Yeah, so many people are like, cash is trash. I don't think I need it. Yeah. And then a pandemic hits and then you're like, oh, that's why cash is
necessary. Exactly. I mean, yeah, that's, 12 months is a very conservative amount of money to, you know, to have set aside. Like, typically, I feel like a lot of folks will say 3 months, you know, or, you know, 3 to 6 months.
Right.
But yeah, love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think this is, again, one of the benefits of working with real people and understanding what it means to not have that money and the bad decisions you're forced to make when you don't have that little nest egg. I think what people fail to understand is whatever emergency you think you're thinking about, most people will say, oh, it's an emergency reserve fund because, you know, my boiler blew up and I have to spend, you know, $4,000 on a new boiler, right? That's one kind of an emergency. The emergency that I'm much more worried about is the emergency where your earning capacity is really curtailed. You know, when you look at pre-pandemic, well, I'll give you an example. I have a friend who's a dermatologist, and she lives in the New York metropolitan area, and, you know, she makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And this year, she will make less than $100,000.
It's a big difference.
Big difference. And for the people who work for her in our office, who might have been making, you know, let's say that you were a technician, and you were somebody who was in a big office like that, you were making $80,000 a year, and now you're going to make $35,000 a year. And so you might even be lucky because you'd be able to retain your job. Now, if I'm somebody who likes statistics, which I am admittedly, and I like probability, and I like to understand outcomes, I will tell you that the devastating outcome is far worse than the upside potential makes your life better. Mm. And that's what people don't understand, that it's sort of the same concept of, if I have a balanced portfolio, chances are I'll be just fine. But in a downturn, do I trust myself to stick with that portfolio that's really aggressive? We'll see. I mean, a lot of people just found out the answer to that question over the last couple of months.
Yeah, for sure. And that's number 6 on your list is the risky investment options. And so, yeah, what are some of the big ways that you see individual investors getting too risky with their investments to their detriment?
I think that one of the things that becomes quite alluring is this fear of missing out on something. And we've all felt that. I could think about the 2005, 2006, 2007 era, right? And everybody, you guys are probably too young, but, you know, I just knew a ton of people who were making so much money in real estate. They're just
flipping homes,
crushing it, right? And like making money hand over fist. And I go back even before that, I knew people in the tech boom of the 90s who, you know, unless they were working for companies, you know, like those people, you know, really did make real money. But, you know, people who were buying and selling stocks and day trading and making a lot of money. And there was always a part of me that was like, oh, I must be an idiot that, like, I don't know, I don't feel comfortable with that. Like, something's not right here. And then the bottom falls out and you realize, oh, that's risky. Well, I think we just had that lesson on steroids. I think that we came into 2020 in a, you know, the longest bull market on record in stocks, the longest expansion on record for the economy. And the attitude was almost a blatant disregard for the fact that the money that was invested in the stock market, in some of the edgier bonds, in some of these private equity and hedge funds that are just totally dopey and mostly not worth it, that the risk essentially was always there. But because markets were rising, people just ignored it. And so everyone feels like a hero in a bull market. I can take risk. I can take risk. And I don't know about you guys, but in March, I got some pretty scary number of people who were freaking out. And why were they freaking out? Because they had so much risk in their portfolio. And of course, they knew it on the way in, but they just didn't pay attention to it.
Well, I mean, yeah. So like kind of on that note, you know, one of the dumb things you mentioned in your book that folks do is when they do try to time the market. And so like, do you see a difference between, you know, buying when the market is on sale versus trying to time the market? Like, is there a difference to you?
It depends. Okay. I admit in the book that I tried to time the market and I got one leg really right and became like locally famous for it because I called the top of the tech bubble. And then I missed getting back in, which is always the other leg of the journey that's very difficult about timing the market. Here's what I think is a little different. All right, I'll use myself as a case. in March, I had to make a – I thought, you know, taxes were due, right, in April, right? And so I was like, the market's off. I'm going to just put all the money in my – I have a personal 401k and a defined benefit plan. And I was like, the market's off pretty dramatically. I'm just going to pop it all in right now. Right now. Done. And I did that. And now the market kept going down. And I didn't say, oh, I wish I bought the bottom. But, you know, so there's money that has to get invested. I thought I had a month to invest it. And I was like, market's down. Might as well do it now. Versus this. I'm going to wait until the market goes to blank. And then I'll get in. And then not actually ever getting in and then coming back to, you know, now and being like, oh, no, I wish I'd gotten back in. So I think that a lot of people are trying to figure out what is the intersection of market timing versus risk management. And, you know, one of the things that I think is important is if you learned a very nasty lesson about risk over the past 90 days, it's okay to change your allocation. You thought you were a 90% stock, 10% bond kind of investor. You learned in the downturn that you freaked out. You really can't take risk like that. And you're really more of a 70-30. I'm okay with you going 70-30 as long as you don't start messing around with it once the market starts going higher. So it's whatever you've learned out of this period, you create a system, you stick to the system. I'm not one for timing the market so much anymore. I mean, I used to love trading. It was a fun thing. I don't do it anymore. So I have someone else manage my money, by the way. I don't even do it for myself because I don't want to get sucked into that world. There's a certain amount of discipline and time and energy that's required, and I don't have it anymore. So I think that if you want to have like a fun money account and play a little bit, great, go do it. Good luck.
Yeah, no, I think that's some good advice, Jill. Hey, we've got a few more questions for you on a few other subjects that you covered in your book, including buying a home versus renting, and we'll get to some of those right after the break.
All right, we're back from the break talking here with Jill Schlesinger. And yeah, let's talk about renting versus buying, Jill. We're totally with you on the American obsession with buying a home. You mentioned this in your book. Renting can often be a much better move for folks. But why do you think so many people refuse to see the light on this one?
Because we are our parents' children. I actually think that is true. If you talk to anybody who is over the age of 40, they have parents who drilled into them that you must own something. Otherwise, you are throwing away your money or the, you know, you're throwing your money down the drain. Why are you renting? And I think the problem is that real estate never was quite as good an investment as everybody made it out to be. Here's why. You know, I think about my parents. My parents bought their first home in 1962, okay? And so when my parents bought their house for, I think, $25,000, and then, you know, outside of, you know, in the suburbs of New York, and then when they ultimately sold it before they moved to another house, but let's call it 1960, early 60s to late 80s, and they sold it for $600,000, okay? Now, you might say, oh my God, look at all the money you made. But actually, which I proved to my father and made him so depressed, he did make good money. But when you account for inflation, housing prices just really go up with the pace of inflation. It's amazing. Now, there are big spikes in certain times and there are dips in certain times. But over the long haul, most people who own real estate, it's an investment that does maybe a little bit better than the pace of inflation, which is fine. That's great. So I think the problem is that there's like a romance around it. You know, that is why these funny home decorating magazines exist. And that's why these shows, Flip This House, and all these kinds of home improvement shows get, you know, it is real estate porn, right? It's so much fun to look at it. But I think that if you really run the numbers for each family, many families would have been better off renting and not owning. And I think the compulsion to own is a big mistake because it does sap people of the liquidity, the extra money they might need to have options down the line. And that's really my main point about renting versus owning, that you never know until you run the numbers. And for some people, it's great. Ownership is great. But don't just go into it without actually considering what the alternative is. Like, you don't make an investment without saying, okay, what am I comparing this to? My risk-free return, right? I'm making an investment to compare to what I could earn on a 10-year treasury. Okay, great. Now, let me go from there. You need a comparison. And you can do this in every single market. All you have to do is you can, you know, pop into a calculator, a rent versus buy calculator, and you can see. And also, it takes you off the hook. So many people who live in these high-priced markets, they feel such pressure, and all of a sudden, it's like, you don't have to feel such pressure. Relax. Who says you have to buy a house?
Yeah, and especially in some of those high-cost markets, it even makes more sense to rent in the higher-cost cities, right?
Oh, definitely.
And so you were talking about how you proved your dad wrong, and you made him a little depressed, telling him about how bad of a decision he made buying that house. Jill, number 11 on your list of dumb money moves is smart people that smart people make is saddling their kids with their own money issues. So can you explain how parents can negatively affect their children's view of money? How does that happen?
Well, you know, it's so, you know, let me just say that as my therapist always liked to point out, it's always your parents' fault.
So true.
So I don't think people mean to do this, but we carry with us in our DNA our stories, right? And our histories and our origin stories. And I always felt this, you know, the one nice thing about my family is that because my father was very open and honest about his views around money, that money was a means to an end, that money was a way for him to live a life. I think my mother wished he had a little more, let me just be honest. And, you know, that we could talk about it in a way where it wasn't loaded. But in so many families, money's a loaded topic because it could be that your first generation mother killed herself to like make everything she has. And when she sees you in her eyes, sort of taking that for granted, it makes her nuts. And so maybe she wants to control you with money. And, you know, I have a very good friend whose parents were so miserly, and she actually went the other way. So she felt like she was robbed of so many experiences because her parents were just so freaked out about money all the time that she overly indulges her kids and overly indulges them even as they are adults. And so these patterns that are created in your life are really important to try to acknowledge so that you don't necessarily react to them or buy into them as you have kids of your own. Notice, by the way, I have no children, which is why my cousin and I hope to write the next book, which is called The Non-Parent's Guide to Parenting.
It's so much easier said than done.
Totally.
Right?
I mean, I think there's some truth there, though, as well. Like, you joke about it, but when you're not in that situation, I think you do have the ability to kind of see things in a clearer light.
Oh, like, yeah.
One of the things you mentioned earlier that stood out to me, and I should have jumped on it then, but you talked about you're talking to your friend's kid who was considering, was it like $90,000 in debt for school? And what was cool there is that you were able to talk to him about it in sort of a, you know, a more objective way, in a way that he would not have been receptive to
if his parents had been
if he was hearing that from his dad.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
a nice, but that's actually a good point in that sometimes I am brought, when I was an advisor, I was brought in as this impartial third party. I was brought in for, parents with their kids, maybe their adult kids, to give the bad news. Like, you know how mom and dad have been giving you gifts every year, $15,000? They're not doing that anymore. Let me explain why. And it was easier for me to say it. They couldn't even say it to their own kids. It's sort of sad. But I was also brought in to help adult children talk to their parents. You guys are too young for this, but it is a bizarre experience to watch your parents age and to then be in the position where you're trying to take care of them. And so many people are taking care of their aging parents and having a hard time discussing money openly because maybe their parents are not comfortable with that and maybe their parents feel less than because of that. And, you know, what I always try to say is if someone else can be your third party and help you have the conversation, that's fantastic. All you want to do is facilitate the conversation, and you are going to be feeling so much better about the intergenerational issues that are arising.
Yeah, no, that's such a good point. Sometimes you need that other perspective to come in because, even in my relationship with my parents, having that conversation, it's gotten easier over the years, but it's never been easy. And so sometimes having somebody else that isn't at the heart of the issue, it can help drive that conversation forward.
Absolutely. And, I know it's hard, gang. I'm not saying it's easy, but not having the conversation, talk about like the, risk reward on that, not having the conversation, what you got. It's not good.
That's a good point.
This is my last little pitch about the older people is that, I've gotten a lot of questions in the last couple of months about estate planning. And there's nothing that drives me crazier than people who don't have a will. I mean, I shame them into having will. I've worked with so many people at CBS. I shame them. Like every day I would say, did you call this attorney? Did you call the attorney? And it's interesting, like the story about risk. What's the risk that you're taking? The risk you're taking by not doing that is that your family is going to clean up a load of crap that you have left on the front door. Your inaction creates a lot of pain, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of work for your family that is unnecessary. The easiest thing in the world is to draft a will. Not doing it is just supremely selfish.
Yeah, that's a great final point. Jill, this has been a wonderful conversation. We so appreciate you coming on and chatting with us. And so where can people find out more about you?
They can go to my website, jillonmoney.com. And, I do a podcast called Jill on Money. Isn't that funny? Just, amazing. Same name. And you won't be surprised that because we've been just inundated with emails, we've moved from twice a week to every day. Can you believe it?
Man, you're podcasting way harder than we are.
I'm exhausted.
Well, you can't tell, Joe. We really appreciate the experience, the knowledge that you've brought to this conversation today. And thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, Matt. That was a great conversation with Jill on Money, Jill Schlesinger. And she's just got so much great perspective, so many good stories. And I enjoyed hearing about her history as an options trader.
How cool was that, hearing about the trading floor, the pit? I had no idea that it was that physical. It's not my big takeaway, but definitely something, a little something I learned for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Nice little insight into Jill's early career. Yeah, but speaking of big takeaways, Matt, what was your big takeaway from this episode?
Well, man, there's so much that I jotted down as we were talking with her. One, I kind of, came back to at the end of our conversation with her, which was, she was helping her friend's son to understand the impact of student loan debt. And she didn't kind of dive into how exactly she did this. But I think we need to do whatever it takes to kind of understand the true impact of the financial decisions we make, And so maybe for him, she was communicating that like, hey, this is what $90,000 in debt looks like once you graduate. This is what your monthly payment is going to be. You're probably going to be making X amount. So your paycheck's going to look like this every month.
And I know that you like nice cars. And that's out of the question if you've got that student loan
payment.
That's not
going to happen. A third of your paycheck is going to go towards student loans. Just whatever it takes to make it real and concrete. Those normally aren't the steps that we take when we're in the moment. We're in the heat of the moment trying to make these decisions. And most of the time it kind of comes down to, well, I like that college town better. You think about the things on the surface. You don't think about the long lasting impacts of the financial decisions. And I think, you know, whatever it takes for us to wrap our heads around it and to think in that direction could benefit us massively. But yeah, I've got actually one more, but I'm going to let you share yours first before, just in case I steal yours.
Okay.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think just a little more due diligence, a little more thoughtfulness on the front end can help us from plunging into astronomical student loan debt or an ill-fated purchase that ends up plaguing us for years to come and causes us to incur more debt. So yeah, I think that's a great one. My big one is when Jill said, if you can't explain it to somebody else, put the brakes on. When she was talking about financial products and how so many people get into financial products they don't understand. And so yeah, if you are unfamiliar to the point that you can't explain it to one of your friends in just like a chill conversation over a beer, then you shouldn't be doing it. No matter what you're investing in, if you're investing in real estate and you can't really understand the numbers, you can't understand how it works, you don't know whether you're going to be profitable, you shouldn't move forward. And that's why we recommend some of the simpler ways to invest, because it's easier to wrap our minds around. And so many other investment products out there are being sold to us. It's not something we asked for, but somebody else has a lot to gain by selling us that product. And so, yeah, we need to be able to understand it before we say yes, before we invest our funds, before we sign on a dotted line, and just know that there are people out there that are going to try to sell you something that you don't want, that you won't be able to understand, or that's going to be really, really hard to understand, and it's not something that you should be buying anyway.
Yeah, and a lot of times too, the more simple the product, the more likely we are to participate in it, right? Like if we know that like I can go this route and it'll be really simple and it'll actually be something that I follow through on, or there's this other really cool kind of sophisticated route and I'm not totally sure how that works and I'm just going to not take any action because I'm kind of confused, you know, indefinitely. That's not the position you want to be in.
And definitely a route for getting burned.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, I've got one bonus big takeaway. There at the end, we're kind of talking about her counselor, you know, how she's saying that, and all counselors say this, a lot of them say how so many of the different issues that we deal with have to do with our parents.
Wait a second, your dad listens to the show, okay? Don't go too hard on him.
No, this is applicable to me as well as you and all of our listeners, but to keep in mind that we oftentimes do think the way our parents do, right? But she also gave an example of where she knew somebody who basically overcorrected. And so they were trying to go as far as they could possibly from their parents. Either way, whichever side of the fence you fall on, it's important, I think, to be aware of that because we need to know what it is that's shaping the way that we think about money, whether that's negative or positive, or maybe you're not even considering that. Maybe you're just trying to find something that's maybe the polar opposite of whatever it is that your parents did. It's so important, I think, for us to keep that in mind, you know, when it comes to how we deal with our money and why it is that we have certain attitudes towards our personal finances. But yeah, little bonus one wanted to mention as well.
Yeah, that was good stuff. All right, Matt, let's mention the beer that we had on the show. Today we drank a beer called Wedge Salad. It's a triple dry hopped Imperial IPA by two of our favorite breweries, Other Half and Green Bench.
Yeah.
Different parts of the East Coast down in Florida and New York.
New York, yeah.
But yeah, what'd you think about this beer, man?
Well, first of all, I want to start with the name, which is Wedge Salad, which has got to be the perfect name for an IPA. Specifically, because oftentimes I'll describe an IPA, in particular New England style IPAs, as sort of having this blue cheese kind of funkiness going on. And I could not think of a better name for a food that makes you think of blue cheese than a wedge salad, right? You know, blue cheese crumbles, a little bit of bacon. So first of all, they kind of won me over already with that. But man, this beer was so good. Bright, juicy, dank though at the same time. But I kind of keep going back to it being bright. It just tastes so fresh. It felt like alive in my mouth. This was a fantastic IPA, a great collaboration between two really great breweries. I'm actually just bummed that I don't have my Other Half hat on right now. I feel like that would make the experience even better.
Yeah, you picked that up when we got to visit their tap room and they had so many delicious IPAs on draft. It wasn't even funny.
Yeah, it was so good, man. But yeah, how about you? What were your thoughts on this beer?
Yeah, so this one was triple dry hopped. And so I feel like I was completely feeling just a massive amount of dry hopping. I feel like it's the difference between watching something in high def or 4K. High def's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
That's a nice picture, but the 4K adds a little element.
It's even better, baby.
And that's the way these hops are when with the triple dry hop. I feel like my taste buds are kind of popping off my tongue a little bit. It's this all-encompassing mouthfeel. So yeah, I'm a big fan. Anything that Other Half ever makes, I will always give it a shot.
Pretty much going to be a fan of them. Yeah, every single time.
Yeah, and Green Bench, these two breweries did a great job making this beer together. So yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Plus the label is awesome too. It's got this nice green, and then it's just like this pattern of basically a wedge of iceberg lettuce, like kind of poke it out all over the place.
With a fork coming out of it.
So stinking good. That's fantastic great. Beer. I'm glad we were able to. We actually picked this one up while you and I were on a bike ride the other day. So it's like a perfect culmination of our relationship in this podcast as well.
Beer and bikes, man, and then talking about money.
That's right.
All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. For folks that want more information and the show notes for this particular episode, you can go to our website, howtomoney.com.
Yeah, we'll have some links to where you can learn more about Jill up there as well. And we want to thank you for being a subscriber to the podcast. And in particular, if you enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to head over to Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave us a solid review over there. That helps us to get the word out and for others to find our show who aren't doing smart things with their money. So, Joel, that's going to be it for this episode, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.